This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Time once again to check on Northwest Indiana Veterans Matters. And for that, we turn to Tom Pappas, who is a member of the Portage City Veterans Committee. And he has a guest with us in the studio as well, too, to talk about Northwest Indiana Veterans Affairs. And in particular, the usual monthly meeting that is coming up this week in Portage. Tom, thank you for being with us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you for having me, and welcome home, everybody.
And I'll let you introduce your guest in the studio.
This is Dave Clark. He makes meetings on a very regular basis.
That's great.
Hi, Dave.
Speaking of meetings, let's talk about what's coming up here this week's meeting in Portage and your special guest coming in.
This is a very important meeting, in my opinion. It's as important as a town hall meeting we had back in September. The VA is starting a new program called My VA. And we have the regional director for that program. And basically, and I have a whole list of things it's supposed to do, but basically it's supposed to open the lines of communication so that if a veteran has an issue, they can find the appropriate person within the VA system to help them with their problem.
And they shouldn't be confused with the programs that VA has out there. It's available online for VA for veterans to be able to access their information.
Yes.
Something different. Maybe it's related, but this is something different in particular.
Well, and this is a component of this program is what they call Veterans Engagement Boards, and there are only two of them in the state. One is in Fort Wayne, and one is in Indianapolis, and the Indiana Department of Veterans Affairs runs that one out of Indianapolis. Mm-hmm. And this is really an extension of the MyVA program because this is supposed to have a two-way communication component where if you have an issue, the VA wants to know what those issues are. And this is the way to get the issue to the VA now.
Now, Lynette Taylor, who is the Indiana-Illinois Relationship Manager, as her title is, she's coming in from Indy, or is she coming in from
She's coming in from Chicago.
From Chicago. Yeah.
She has the whole northern end of Indiana and part of Illinois, mostly the Chicago area.
Obviously, it must be a much extensive service. At least my VA has been set up in Illinois, so that's working apparently very well there, and it's expanding here in Indiana.
It's just beginning. Every state is supposed to have at least one Veterans Engagement Board, and they have regional directors in all the states to make this thing happen.
Is it likely that because we're so close to Chicago and the operations there, not that we're going to be merged with Chicago, but that because we're so close that we'll have some connection, I suppose, with the offices there in Chicago to help veterans?
I've already approached Ms. Taylor about having Portage be the Northwest Indiana Veterans Engagement Board, okay? We're the only ones in the northern end of the state that are doing educational things. Everybody else, in my opinion, is doing, my terminology, touchy-feely.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They're making veterans feel better, but are they really helping the veterans solve their problems? No, they're not.
Mm-hmm. Which we know that the Portage City Veterans Committee has been basically set up to be able to do that.
Yes.
That's what you've been doing all along, with not only with the regular informational meetings and having guests come in, but doing the other programs.
And we're introducing veterans to the VA officials can make things happen. As an example, back in September, we had a gentleman out of Rensselaer come in, had $25,000 worth of choice bills that were unpaid because he came to the meeting, talk to the right VA official that was at the meeting, his bills got paid.
Mm-hmm. Now, Dave Clark, since you're a member of the committee and you sit in on the meetings, what are you hoping that you'll be able to get out of the session coming up this week with Ms. Taylor?
Well, first of all, a better understanding. Well, first of all, thank you for having me on.
Mm-hmm.
But a better understanding of exactly what the new program is going to do for the veteran, the individual veteran that may have some issues going forward. I'm looking forward to something that's more than, as Tom put it, touchy-feeling, mm-hmm. something that has some substance to it, maybe a slight change in the way VA does business with respect to each individual veteran.
Now, have you had any, in particular, any individual issues or concerns that, you've addressed with your colleagues that attend the committee meetings that you've had to bring up with the VA in particular?
Nothing particular. They want to be my medical care provider, so I'm going to let them. And that's one for that's a good example of things that maybe some of the veterans don't out there don't know about yet. There are a whole bushel basket full of things that the VA can help veterans with, but they won't do it. They're not going to come to your house and knock on your door. You have to educate yourself, move forward toward exactly tell them what you need, and see who they have to contact within the system.
Right. And now, that's what this MyVA, the basis for this is to get the veterans hooked up with the right people.
We should mention that the next meeting is coming up back to tomorrow, Wednesday the 1st at 5 o'clock in the evening. And as always, these Portage Veterans Committee meetings are held at the Sycamore Room at Woodland Park, which is on Willow Creek Road in Portage. And everybody's welcome. You don't have to be from just Portage or from Porter County. You can be from any place here in Northwest Indiana.
Like I said, we had them come from Rensselaer, Michigan City. We welcome any veteran because, again, there's no one in the northern end of the state that's doing this. There's no one resource where you can go to and say, well, who can I talk to or get some good information?
We talked here about the veterans' health care issues and programs that are available, and we'll find out more here with this meeting from Ms. Lynette Taylor on the MyVA program in particular. We know that that there have been efforts made on Capitol Hill, and of course, U.S. Senator Joe Donnelly, our Democratic representative on the Senate from Indiana, has been working on it on a number of issues. And the latest one that he is introducing is a bill on Capitol Hill, which is called the Protecting Veterans Credit Act. And from what we understand from Senator Donnelly's office, that the measure would be an effort to protect the credit ratings of veterans who may be wrongly penalized because of delays in the reimbursements that they have been getting from the Department of Veterans Affairs on the medical bills that they have rung up. There are some who've been billed inappropriately for services because the VA hasn't paid the health care providers in a timely fashion. That's probably especially the case with veterans who are taking advantage of the VA Choice program. They're going outside the regular VA hospital and clinic system to get special help or closer help maybe to where they live that they don't happen to have. And so they're getting billed by these hospitals or these other privately or community-owned health care clinics.
What's prompted that bill, and it's excellent, Senator Joe Donnelly is really a friend of Indiana's veterans. What prompted that bill was if you remember, I brought up a few months ago that the American Federation of Government Employees had told their employees to sit on the bills and not pay doctors in a timely fashion, with the intent of getting those doctors to withdraw from the Choice program and force veterans to stay within the VA system. The union is afraid that a lot of veterans, and I don't blame them for being afraid, will take advantage of the Choice Act to stay locally. I mean, myself, I don't want to drive an hour and a half to Jesse Brown for a routine medical exam or something when I have a community-based outpatient clinic, Adam Benjamin, 5 minutes from where we're talking right now.
That's right. It's a concern, I know, and a lot of people, of course, I think they have said they felt a little constricted by the fact that they have to go this route. But just the same, if they do take advantage of the Choice program, they may run into some other problems of their own.
Yes.
And some other veterans I know have mentioned that, and you have mentioned that they have brought these matters up at the Portage Veterans Committee meetings in the past about having to go so far for service, and they have the advantage now to be able to stay closer to home for the care they need. But obviously some of them are still being billed, and the bills aren't getting
paid. And seeing that, this is just one example of why I've asked to be a Veterans Engagement Board site, because instead of once or twice a year bringing somebody in that can address these billing issues or healthcare issues, we can provide direct input to the VA that, hey, this is a problem. You better get somebody here to help us fix the problem.
So we know that Senator Joe Donnelly is going to introduce the bill. If he hasn't done so already, he will introduce sometime this week in the Senate to have his colleagues in the Senate take this up. With any luck, it'll be passed there and then go on to the House of Representatives. And I'm sure that he has lined up assistance in the House of Representatives as well to get this matter pushed through and get it enacted.
Yes, he seems to be very good at working both sides of the aisle. Mm-hmm.
One of the things that, as well as a veterans issue, not as drastic or not as a major as talking about health care and the like, is something that veterans who are seniors as well as homeowners in the city of Gary should be able to take advantage of a very special program, and that's thanks to a community impact grant that has come from Home Depot. The city of Gary sent out a news release not long ago talking about this. The city of Gary picked up a $5,000 community impact grant from the Home Depot Foundation, which does a lot of these grants that they do all across the country. And it's great what they do because a lot of people need the help in getting their homes fixed up, certainly for winterization this time of year for us and the rest of the year and other problems that veterans have. They can't afford to get their homes fixed up and get a little help to be able to do that. And so the applications are available right now. At the Community Development Department, which is at 839 Broadway in downtown Gary. Applications have to be completed between February 1st, tomorrow, and February 20th. And you can find out more information by contacting the city of Gary about this. They'll be happy to pass along. And if you put the application in, you stand the chance of getting something to help pay for some home improvement measures.
And see, I didn't know much about that. I've gone over to Lake County over here, and I've invited a number of the shakers and movers in the veterans community to attend our monthly meetings. They have not. Mm-hmm. And that's a problem because you got to have some centralized way of getting out information. A veteran shouldn't have to pick up a newspaper and read it in the paper. They should be able to have a direct source to keep them informed about what's going on.
Now, Tom, we just have a little time left here in our conversation. Let's talk about what is on the at least the planning calendar for the months ahead on some of the meetings.
I'm got scheduled for March. Judge Julia Gent, who formed the Veterans Court in Porter County, and Angela Tucker, who's going to present on suicide prevention. And that's as far as I'm kind of behind. I like to be 2-3 months ahead. I'm working on something big, but I don't want to say anything about it right now.
If you're still working on that, you probably have some things, some more strings to pull, and they'd like to be able to get that done.
I had the network in Washington, D.C., so.
that's good. Dave Clark, do you have anything else you'd like to add as we close up the conversation?
No, Chris, I really don't, but thank you very much for having us on.
Oh, you're welcome. Well, thank you very much. Dave Clark, who's one of the members of the Portage City Veterans Committee, attends the meetings, and, of course, Tom Pappas, who's a member of the City Veterans Committee in Portage, talking about the meeting coming up, which is tomorrow evening, again, Wednesday evening. It's going to happen at 5 o'clock in the evening. It'll be at the Sycamore Room of Woodland Park, which is at 2100 Willow Creek Road in Portage.
Right.
Gentlemen, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you again, Chris.
Dog tags aren't real fancy. They were punched out of metal for most people who are in the service, either at basic training or maybe sometime in between the time that they joined up and the time that they left the service. I still have my dog tags from Navy boot camp. But in this case here, a set of dog tags have helped lead to a search for a veteran's family. And we find out more about that. It was from a story recently in the Northwest Indiana Post-Tribune, and Meredith Colias was a writer and a producer of that story, and Meredith is with us to talk about it. Meredith, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
Sure, thank you for having me.
Well, tell us first about how you in turn found out about these dog tags, who they belong to, or at least who has possession of them now, and how they've come across over the years to lead up to a man from World War II service.
I would say probably about last month, the story was going around social media that there was a young man who had found a pair of dog tags in his late uncle's belongings, and his uncle, it looks like, was a scrapper who lived in Lake Station. And so his name was C.J. Miller, and he kind of just took it upon himself. He really wanted to see if he could get it back to the family. And since, historically the Post Tribune has been based in Gary, where the address on the dog tags were, we kind of just thought we would step in and see if we could help him locate the family.
Now, when it's time to pick up a set of dog tags, there's not much information on there, basically name and the serial number, maybe the rank, and some other information on there. It doesn't tell, obviously, where a person lives or where a person came from. How did you have to go back and get some help in going through the records to find out more about this person?
Sure. Well, that's a good question. Actually, the address was on there. Dog tags have varied throughout the years, where the military has sort of changed what information they put on there. Sort of how we knew that they were World War II dog tags was that the military at that time had put specific information during that era, which was, you know, something like the name of the soldier, obviously, serial number, and also next of kin and next of kin address, which was on there, which was the listed address on Madison Street in Gary. So that's really where the sort of where the story started, is that there was an address on there, which was very helpful. And then we tracked down the surviving family members through obituaries and things like that. So
I suppose that was probably because, unfortunately, back then, World War II, a lot of people were fighting and they were dying for their country, and dog tags on a victim's body would probably be the only way they could start the identification process.
Well, that's true today, certainly. Mm-hmm.
When you had a chance to go through this information, what did Mr. Miller have to say about the find? He said he came across with his from his uncle's belongings, but what did he seem to think about having these dog tags in his possession at first?
Sure. Well, it was kind of a little bit of a mystery in the family too, because his late uncle had apparently a lot of different possessions, and the late uncle's name was Don Halford, and apparently. His nephew, C.J. Miller, had just kind of come upon these dog tags really, in the past several weeks. The uncle had passed away in 2015, and C.J. Miller had said over the years that they had been very close, and so he just kind of came upon these by, just kind of really randomly, and once he found them, he just felt that his late uncle was a man who was very patriotic and revered the military himself, he told me. And so he kind of also wanted to honor his uncle's memory by trying to return them to the family.
Now, Meredith, tell us, if you will, a little about this fellow who was the owner of the dog tags, Donald Dykeman. Tell us what you learned about him, about his family, and what he was doing here in Northwest Indiana before he went into the service.
Sure, absolutely. A lot of it really just comes from records at this point. Mr. Dykeman, it looks like he was born in Richmond, Indiana. He spent several years of his life in Gary. It looks like, in Gary's Glen Park neighborhood. According to what we had found in past posthumous stories, dating back to the 1950s, when he passed away in 1951, he graduated from Emerson High School. It looks like he might have worked for the YMCA for a short period and worked for the county for a short period. It appears as well that even though the dog tags themselves had dated back to World War II, that he may have had some military experience prior to that, having enlisted briefly in the late 20s, and then possibly being an Army reservist from about 1931 to 41. So we do know that Mr. Dykeman has, had very deep roots in Gary, and more than likely lived most of his life there.
Now, we have these dog tags that's been discovered to be belonging to this gentleman who lived in Gary and went into the service. What is going to happen to these dog tags now, and is anybody going to claim them and anything else that they may happen to have on this fellow?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question. Well, part of the complications, and you would imagine being so long since Mr. Dykeman did pass away, in 1951, there's not a lot of immediate family members that are still in the area. His daughter-in-law now lives in Florida, but his daughter-in-law's sister still lives in Northwest Indiana, and she's kind of been, will be the liaison, for the family and Mr. Miller. So she plans to get the dog tags back, and at this point, it's kind of her plan, as far as I understand, that she's going, since she was related to the Dykeman family by marriage through her sister, that she's going to try to track down, a few of his nieces that either, maybe living in Arizona possibly, and see if they would want them. And if not, then she said that she might kind of look around and see where she can donate them to. I know that last month, this particular story had gotten a lot of interest on social media, and so at that time, the Porter County Museum had kind of come forward and said that they would be happy to add them to their World War II collection, you know, if the family wished. I'm not sure what Melissa Angus, who is the daughter-in-law's sister, wants to do at this point. She certainly has options either way.
I imagine there are probably some resources too that can take advantage of in putting it, since it is a small bit of Lake County history, that some organization here in Lake County might be interested in this.
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. At this point, so you know, there are, you know, certain options of people who are willing to step in, and even the Porter County Museum said themselves that this is commonly a service that they provide. Where you know, they even said quite frankly, when you know, they have a lot of examples, you know, even weekly, of people, you know, cleaning out their garages and finding things of this nature that, you know, obviously shouldn't be thrown away, but then they are happy to take in because it represents such a, you know, important part of local history and an important part of, you know, a family's history, which was the interesting thing, too, to point out, is that Melissa Angus had mentioned that they actually were kind of mystified by how this, you know, all came up, because over the years, Mr. Deckman's son had kept several mementos of his father, because his son, Don Dyckman Jr., was only about six when Mr. Dyckman died, it looks like, of heart condition. Mm-hmm. And so he sort of, you know, grew up and really, you know, the words were, he worshipped his father, and for years, you know, kept mementos and military uniforms and things like that of his father. And so Melissa Angus, who sort of, you know, obviously knew the family by marriage, had said, well, you know, over the years she knew that he had all these things, but the dog tags had never come up as being missing. So they didn't even know that they were gone. So that they were as surprised as anyone to learn that, you know, Mr. Miller was looking for them and looking to return sort of a lost piece of family history.
We're talking with a Post Tribune reporter, Meredith Coleus, who's written a story, you can see it online as well as in print, about how a set of dog tags from a man who had lived in Northwest Indiana served in the military, and the dog tags in turn have led to the search by the person who has picked up those dog tags through his uncle's late uncle's belongings, and in turn found the family members of this gentleman. Meredith, thanks for the information, and I hope they have a chance to follow through and find out more information to see how this search and more information is coming back into Lake County about this this fellow from Northwest Indiana, who had served in the military, and his dog tags have now turned into a bit of history as well, too.
Thank you.
News came out today from NDOT that we will no longer see, as of the end of February, going into the 1st of March, the distinctively colored cars on the Hoosier State Passenger Rail Service. Iowa Pacific, which is the firm that had been handling the equipment provided for the Amtrak service, is changing back to, I guess, turning things back over to Amtrak. And some people are not very happy about that decision that has been announced. One of those people who has definitely something to say about it is Steve Coxhead. He's the president of the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance, and we have him here with us to talk about his reaction to the news from Iowa Pacific and from NDOT as well, and what lies ahead for the Hoosier State. Steve, thanks for being with us today.
Good afternoon, Chris.
If you will, tell us what you understand from what you've learned, because more than just the news releases from NDOT and from Iowa Pacific, as to what has brought things to this point that Iowa Pacific has had to change its mind and turn, or will be turning, the equipment back over to Amtrak.
Long story short, basically the contract between Iowa Pacific and Amtrak, one of the provisions of that contract basically split the revenues up between the two organizations. It got to the point where Iowa Pacific did not understand that it could continue to finance their operations with the amount of money they were getting under the contract, and so they requested that they be released from the contract. And Amtrak then stepped forward and agreed to provide service for the remainder of the contract, which I think runs until the end of June of this year.
Now, obviously, we know that that Amtrak has had the service before. They did have the equipment, the locomotives and the cars and the like, as well as continuing to now offering, of course, the ticketing service and working on how the tracks are set up for the trains that run from Chicago to Indianapolis and vice versa, and the crews for those trains as well. So it's not like Amtrak got out of the business. They've just kind of taken a different role, and now they're taking things back over?
Well, yeah. I mean, Iowa Pacific's exit appears to have everything to do with Iowa Pacific's own internal finances and their business plan. My understanding is they're having some problems in other parts of the country with other operations as well. So the good news is it does not appear to be something specifically about the Hoosier State that created the problem. It was more something about the private sector partner that NDOT had partnered with. Amtrak will be providing the service on the same schedule. Of course, the difference, as most of us see, is that the level of service that Amtrak can or is willing to provide is not the same as Iowa Pacific was providing. Some of us believe that it was that high level of service that, in fact, was attracting increasing riders and higher revenues to the service. However, it is not as if the state of Indiana, for instance, has pulled the plug. There is still a line item in NDOT's budget request for the next two-year budget that would be the state's contribution to the operation of the Hoosier State. As far as we know, that line item is still in there, and no one has made any aggressive moves to replace it or to remove it. So we're basically seeing a commitment, I think, on the part of the state of Indiana to explore modern passenger rail service in the state. It's not so much the state backing away, but unfortunately the state's private sector partner. Fortunately, Amtrak was able to step in and fill the gap. Now, we have to remember that 2-3 years ago when NDOT sent out an RFP for this service, Amtrak was basically one of the people that indicated an interest in providing the service. So we're really falling back from, let's say, the first-choice vendor to maybe the second-choice vendor. So, you know, there's good and there's bad here. The downside is Amtrak service levels generally are not as good as Iowa Pacific has provided. On the other hand, we still have the service. The commitment from the state of Indiana is there, and we're moving forward.
I know one of the things that Iowa Pacific was particularly proud of and was marketing very heavily, and to their success, at least for as long as they had the service, was the amenities that they've been able to add, such as Wi-Fi, the business class seating on the Hoosier State, a lot of improvements as well, too, and the meal service and the like that they worked very hard to be able to establish while Iowa Pacific had the train. So in the hopes, I think that we're hoping that Amtrak is able to be able to pick up some of those amenities or at least get some cooperation from the communities along the route to help foot the cost.
Well, Amtrak has increased the amenities on its own long-distance train, the Cardinal, mm-hmm. Which follows the same route. I don't know. I'm going to reserve judgment on that because system-wide, Amtrak's driving mode is system-wide, and this is because of what comes out of Washington, has been to reduce costs, okay, and minimize on service. They have not and do not at this time really have a mandate to provide world-class service. Here again, that comes from Washington because Amtrak is controlled by Congress and, you know, annual appropriations, and the emphasis has always been to cut costs, to minimize service, which is a problem. I don't know if Amtrak is going to be able to overcome that. However, what we saw with the Iowa Pacific service was that there's a market for a premium service in this country. Trying to do bare bones is probably counterproductive. No one likes bare bones service. You know, would you take a Volkswagen Bug to Chicago if you could drive in a limo? You know, would you fly economy coach if you can afford first class? So I think that is the open question, whether Amtrak is going to be able to step up and not just provide service, provide the kind of premium service that 21st century America really wants and many of us feel is willing to pay for.
Now, we should, of course, mention right now that nothing has changed, nothing will likely change, at least not until the end of February, when the service changeover happens between Iowa Pacific and going back to the Amtrak service. So with any luck, we will see more coming out of either Amtrak or maybe NDOT, since they're working with Amtrak in this venture now, or will be, that the Hoosier State's not going to change. And the hopes that they're trying to attract more than just attract riders to the Hoosier State service, which Iowa Pacific has been able to do, but be able to keep those additional riders going and hopefully keep the idea of keeping more trains on the tracks running between Chicago and Indianapolis, and of course making the stops here in the region in Dyer as well as in Rensselaer. Steve Coxhead is the president of the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance. We have a lot to keep an eye out on between now and the end of February, to be sure, and we'll be back in touch to talk about how some of these developments are coming along. Thank you very much for taking time today, Steve.
Thank you, Chris.
Protests around the country give you an idea of the faces behind the president's ban on immigrants from some Muslim countries. The impact can also be felt here in Northwest Indiana. Lakeshore Public Radio Stephen Lattimore reports that families here are now dealing with the effects of the Trump executive order.
Chicagoland Immigrant Welcome Network in Hammond is an approved remote placement site for refugee resettlement. They are also part of Catholic Charities, and for 3 years, they have provided legal services for immigrants, helped reunite families from overseas, and helped undocumented workers with legal services. The executive director, Tony Burrell, says the president's ban on Muslim refugees will have a ripple effect throughout Northwest Indiana.
So there are families here in Northwest Indiana who have family members who are in dangerous situations overseas. And those family members have successfully made their way through the refugee application process. They've been vetted and they've been interviewed and they've gone through typically 2 to 3 years of this process and are almost at the point where they're ready to fly over here. And now these families are facing 4 months or more delay in being able to see, in many cases, their children or siblings, loved ones.
Advocates for the refugee resettlement program say they go through some of the strictest vetting around.
Since the Refugee Act of 1980, there have been 3 million refugees settled into the United States. Not one of them has committed a terrorist act here in the United States, and that's going 37 years and counting now. So there were vetting measures put into place in 1980. They were revised in 2001. They were revised again in 2010 or 2011. And these are, for the most part, very safe measures. It's the most thoroughly vetted aspect of our entire immigration system is the refugee resettlement program.
Burrell says that most terrorism here in the U.S. is homegrown. If you would like to help the Chicago Welcome Network, you can follow them on Facebook at Welcome Network. Stephen Lattimore, Lakeshore Public Radio.
Indiana Public Broadcasting's Peter Ballinan Rosen reports that the executive order from the White House is now leaving many Indiana colleges and universities scrambling.
For Babak Saraje, it's routine by now. As a celebrated physicist at Indiana University, he travels abroad 3 or 4 times a year for work. Last Saturday, he was heading to Israel.
I left my house at 8:30. You know, I took a shuttle to the airport.
Of course, Saraje had been following the news about the travel ban. He's a legal resident of the U.S. and a dual Canadian-Iranian citizen.
I thought that this is not going to apply to me. I can still, you know, take my trip, and that's why I started my trip.
But it did apply to him. Saraje is one of about 100 Indiana University faculty and staff affected by Trump's order banning travel for people from 7 countries into the U.S., and he was at the airport heading out of the country.
I checked with the airline representatives there about this, and they said, they had some memo that permanent residents were not affected. So I checked in.
But when the connection landed in Newark, it had all changed. Saraje checked the news. He saw reports that dual nationals from those 7 countries could also be barred from returning to the U.S. People like him.
So basically everything that I thought would protect my return home was gone at that point.
And with no guarantee of return, he turned around, put the research on hold, and went home to his family and the assistant professor job he's held for 6 years.
It felt like the ground was shifting under my feet. I just being in a mudslide or something like that. This happened like overnight almost with such sweeping effects. So, you know, whenever I'm going to take another trip, I would be concerned if that can happen again.
And he's not alone. Faculty and staff across the Indiana University system have canceled professional and personal travel.
We are advising them, if they are from one of the seven countries impacted by the travel ban, not to depart the U.S. at this time.
Chris Veers is with Indiana University International Services. He says his phone has been ringing off the hook with students, faculty, and staff looking for answers.
It was nonstop, but our commitment here at IU is to do absolutely everything that we can to proactively communicate what's happening.
For both professors in and out of the country.
An individual that I just spoke with recently is outside of the U.S. He has a German passport, but is originally from Iran, and he's wondering if he will be impacted by the ban, and it's just not quite clear yet.
While people wait for clarification, the university is offering services to help affected faculty, staff, and students deal with stress and anxiety, including information sessions on all IU campuses. Across the university system, about 150 students, about 100 faculty and staff, and 160 prospective students are impacted. Veer says they're not a threat to national security.
Educational exchanges are one of our country's most successful foreign policy tools.
Veer says they combat stereotypes, both at home and abroad. But for now, he's asking people from those seven countries to stay put.
Just because of the uncertainty as to whether or not they will be able to return.
Even as the presidents of universities, including IU, Purdue, and Notre Dame, are condemning the order, faculty like Sarajay are playing it safe. In his office, traces of chalk dust linger on a brown shirt. He's just finished teaching for the day, and he clicks through photos of a past trip.
Ah, here. I can show you this.
Sarajay pulls up a photo of a whiteboard covered in math equations.
So this is a board that with our work on it. So we were working on this, and this turned into a paper. This is in my office there in Ben Gurion University. It feels like I wanted to be there.
For now, he's waiting to see what comes next. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Peter Ballinon-Rosen.
At the State House, legislation that was approved by a House committee on Monday would no longer require adoption agencies to check a national registry of child abuse and neglect cases because, as Indiana Public Broadcasting's State House reporter Brandon Smith tells us, the registry doesn't exist.
State law requires adoption providers to do a criminal history check of prospective adoptive parents. As part of those background checks, providers must consult a national registry of child abuse and neglect cases. But Department of Child Services Legislative Director Parvane Stover says the registry doesn't exist.
I believe Congress passed a law in 2006 requiring the creation of such a registry to have each state aggregate all of their substantiated claims up to one centralized registry, but the registry never happened.
Linda Brooks is the COO of Baptist Children's Home, an adoption provider in Valparaiso. She says one of their adoptions is being held up because state law requires them to check the non-existent registry.
So it's impossible for us to do these checks, and we're concerned that it will not only affect this one adoption, but all our other adoptions in the future.
A House committee unanimously approved the bill. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
Federal appeals court has struck down portions of Indiana's controversial e-cigarette regulations. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brozier reports, the ruling applies to out-of-state manufacturers.
Seventh Circuit Judge David Hamilton writes in the opinion that while portions of the law requiring childproof packaging and clear labeling aren't controversial, only one manufacturer in the entire country meets the strict security requirements included. The legislation requires each e-liquid manufacturer to contract with a security company that meets a long list of stipulations. The opinion says Indiana's law looks, quote, very much like a legislative grant of a monopoly to one favored in-state company in the security business. The court says Indiana can apply those rules to manufacturers within the state, but it does not have the authority to regulate the processes and facilities of out-of-state manufacturers. The vaping law has been embroiled in controversy since it went into effect last year. It sparked an FBI investigation into whether some lawmakers benefited from its passage. Now, some legislators are trying to pass a bill that would repeal many of the regulations. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
The Speed Up Sound with Kyle Meredith.
It isn't as easy to find great rock and roll as it used to be. Something solid, loud, fast, and most importantly, fun. But if the Struts have anything to say about that, we won't have that problem any longer. The new Gods of Glam came roaring out of the gate with fist-pumping, shout-out-loud choruses that keep you on your feet and inspire you to be a better person. Let me introduce you to their lead singer, Luke Spiller. I'm Kyle Meredith at the Speed of Sound. You hear a lot of bands that are writing in between tour stops or whatever, and the next record ends up being the road record. Is that happening to you, or are you kind of pushing against that?
We've been playing so much, we've become musically a tighter unit, and everyone's like focusing in more exactly like on what they're playing, probably more than ever. So I think this next album is going to have more of like a live bandy feel to it, you know, and sort of like apply what we've learned and soaked up on the road, like playing all these shows up and down the country. I think you're gonna hear it on the next one.
Yeah,
because as soon as we get in, that's kind of the way we've always written. We've always wanted like big choruses, you know. We don't sort of like to turn left, so to speak, when it gets to a chorus, and we really kind of like to have a payoff, and we enjoy making upbeat music, you know? Right. And again, it just makes it easier to do live as well, which is a bonus.
You were telling me that song is how old now?
Very old.
Very old.
In terms of a song, it's coming on to an old age pensioner, as we say in the UK. Yeah, I mean, that song in particular is the one that just keeps on giving. Long story short, when we were cutting the original sort of album, as it were, we weren't with the right people and the label that we were on, you know, we weren't exactly like priorities. So we ran out of money and time, essentially, to even finish it. So most of it was still demos. You know, that's a new mastered version and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But there was a song on the album which was recorded in a shed at our house, and we were meant to re-record it and just never had time. We had to throw it on. So that's one example. We managed to land on our feet. We walked away from the label and we surrounded ourselves with new management, and one of our managers basically took that song, and it just started to gain real traction over here in the States. And then we landed the deal with Interscope, and everything's been a gorgeous yellow brick road ever since.
Don't want to live, there's an untold story. Rather go out in a blaze of glory. I can't hear you.
Tell me about this song, Put Your Hands Up. This isn't on the record, right?
It's not, no. Yeah. Again, this is a funny one. This is one of the first songs me and Adam sort of like professionally recorded, as it were, you know, with producer and engineer. And It's a lot older than a lot of the songs on the album now. I think it's six or 7 years old.
Wow.
And we just sort of like kept it. It never really sort of did anything. Mm. And then when we came to revisit all these songs for the new release, for the USA, this one was sort of sat then. It was actually the producer and engineer, Nigel Butler, who sort of said, "Do you remember this one?" And then he like basically sort of like remastered it and sort of spruced it up a bit, and we were like, "Oh god, yeah, this is really good," and everyone just really loved it. So it's done quite well.
It's one of my favorites of yours.
It's a great fan favorite. We open up with it now every night, because it's got like the right tempo for jumping.
Right.
You know, and it's great. It gets everyone going. I mean, going into this next album, the sort of like the basis is I kind of want to reapproach the glam sound. And one which I love in particular is Mott the Hoople, actually, mm-hmm. which is one we haven't spoken about. So I was just going through like a lot of the albums and sort of like the classic songs, but actually looking at like what Ian Hunt has done, like separate, you know, I was sort of really impressed. And I just love the lyrical content. I think Ian Hunt is a fantastic lyricist.
Tell me about the covering Ballroom Blitz.
We were asked to contribute a song from the soundtrack of The Edge of 17 for a specific scene.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually saw it the other day. It's her and her friend getting drunk at home alone, and they're playing this song in the background. So they asked us if we would do it. And so we were like, yeah, okay. So we basically had one day to do it, and we produced it with a fantastic engineer in New York. But it was done in one day. I mean, I enjoyed it. I mean, mm-hmm. I have a little bit of trouble listening to it because I think there's this one flat note which I do, which really bugs me. You know what I mean? This is why, you know, if you're out there, you know, and you want to be a musician or a singer, just, you know, sometimes it is good to be a perfectionist.
Yeah. Now, did they pick the song or did you pick the song?
They asked if,
specifically if they, that song.
Yeah. Because, you know, they were huge, you know, like glam band in, mm-hmm. in the UK. And definitely like a big influence on us, like especially some of their larger songs. The first album, we looked at that specific synth sound that they had and was really inspired by it and tried to sort of like recreate it.
Luke Spiller of the Struts. They'll have a new record out probably sometime next year. In the meantime, though, you can grab their one-off single, Put Your Hands Up, which is out now. For more of my interviews, head to Facebook and Twitter @KyleMeredith. And thanks to Chris Allman for co-producing and editing this episode. And from the studios of WFPK in Louisville, KY, I'm Kyle Meredith at the Speed of Sound.
Speed of Sound can be heard here on Tuesdays and Thursdays here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Postscript to a conversation we had yesterday with Greg Kuzmar, who is the president of the Highland Town Redevelopment Commission. He was talking about yesterday evening's town council vote on the request to be able to handle the project to be able to transform, after renovation, the town theater that had closed up back in 2014 or before, and in turn turned it into what the town of Highland had envisioned as an arts, entertainment, and cultural district. But the town council voted 3-2 against the renovation plans on Monday night. It was to be able to renovate and reopen the 71-year-old theater. The vote took place before a packed house of supporters and opponents. Town council members who voted against the proposal were concerned that town tax funds would be involved in covering any operational costs if the nonprofit theater board could not. Councilman Mark Harack said that the question remains, should the town own and operate a theater? Is operating a theater the town's core competency? Redevelopment Director Cecile Petro says now it's basically not a matter of the theater itself. It was to develop the cultural district, and now the town's going to have to turn to private developers to be able to make it happen. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. We'll be back with you tomorrow.